is Friday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Coming up, the G7 economic meeting starts Saturday. What's in the cards?
We're seeing many more topics of discussion that haven't really come up before. Looking at inequality, gender equality. But of course, the big issues will come down, as always, to trade.
Also, will New Zealand become a new destination for refugees? And pilots from around the world are being recruited to test software for the Boeing 737 MAX jet. Those stories and more are all next. The world's largest advanced democracies, known as the Group of Seven or G7, will have their annual summit this weekend in the French seaside town of Biarritz. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson, earlier today about the agenda for this year's gathering. She starts by explaining that French President Emmanuel Macron has a diverse list of issues to be covered.
What Emmanuel Macron has done with this is he's opened up the G7. We're going to see leaders of other countries, particularly from Africa, from India, Australia, Chile, and South Africa, of course. So we're seeing a wider breadth. We're seeing much more breadth. We're seeing many more topics of discussion that haven't really come up before, and that includes climate change, digital. What are we going to do about a world that is just so far not very well policed when it comes to digital reach? Looking at inequality, gender equality, these sorts of items. But of course, the big issues will come down, as always, to trade. An end of tariffs, more free trading, more equality when it comes to trading. And of course, the big issue we'll come down to again will be Iran and what's going to happen to the Iran nuclear deal.
Mr. Trump, the U.S. president, has put forth the idea of re-inviting Russia and to the grouping and recreating the old G8, Group of Eight. Where do the other members of the G7 stand on this? Is that something that's likely? And does Russia have a presence at this gathering?
Well, first of all, Russia doesn't have a presence at the gathering, and the French have been very keen to make it known that Russia should have some sort of input. And that was why the French president had a very long one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin back on Monday. Now, the French are not keen on this idea, and neither are the Germans keen on the idea that Russia be readmitted to this group of major industrialized countries. It, of course, was thrown out in 2014 after its takeover of Crimea and its actions in eastern Ukraine. The French president and the German chancellor are both trying to get some sort of summit meeting back up and running again with Russia and Ukraine that would bring some sort of dialogue to that situation. There is hope that this could get off the ground but for the time being, the French president and the German chancellor said, no, it is too early to let Russia in.
Now, let's talk a little bit more and in a little more detail about the Africa role on this agenda.
The goal there, in particular with the Sahel, is security. The French, of course, have had a role in the Sahel for a long time, and they feel that the rest of the world really isn't taking the Sahel seriously. The French saying that they need to put again on the table the actual problems of the Sahel, the insecurity, terrorism, weak state institutions, demographics, climate change. The French are keen that they get more help when it comes to initiatives for security, and in particular, they would really like to see some of the G7 nations coming forth with troops, with hardware, to beef up the G5 Sahel. On other areas, they say that they do want new initiatives for the Sahel and new partnerships. Now, those sorts of partnerships would be when it comes to biodiversity, climate change, and of course, that ever-present issue for these major countries, which is migration, the uncontrolled migration from these areas. So they want new partnerships for Africa. Aside from the Sahel, they're also looking at access for credit for women for their economic development. That is a big thing that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has talked about for a long time, this inequality, and particular gender inequality.
That was Catherine Field reporting from Paris. She was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Now, speaking of French President Emmanuel Macron, he is the latest international figure to express alarm related to reports that there are thousands of active fires in the Amazon rainforest, a part of the world known as the planet's lungs, that pushes the number this year to over 70,000. And on Thursday, he said wildfires there are an international crisis and called on leaders attending this weekend's G7 to make this the first issue they discuss. Environmentalists say Brazil's pro-industry president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been encouraging farmers and others to burn the forest so it can be used for development. Peter Glick, a climate expert and the founder of the Pacific Institute, one of the scientists who worked on the original U.S. climate assessment, joined International Edition's Lori London to discuss the crisis.
This is a very, very upsetting situation. We've seen in the last few months really unprecedented numbers of intentionally set fires in the Amazon, set by almost certainly ranchers and farmers trying to expand production of soybeans and ranching on prime forest land. The Amazon provides the single largest chunk of oxygen for the atmosphere. It's an incredibly rich biodiversity refuge. It's a unique ecosystem, and the rapid destruction that we're seeing, the unprecedented destruction that we're seeing, is extraordinarily disturbing on many, many levels.
I'm sure there will be wildlife lost and potentially indigenous people. Are they at risk as well?
Yes, it's everything. It's the wildlife, it's the lungs of the planet, it's the indigenous populations that live in the forest and have lived there for thousands of years who have no protections from the current government in Brazil. It's the ability of the Amazon to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and slow the rate of climate change. All of these things are now being lost.
Obviously, it's gaining a lot of attention. The UN Secretary General tweeting, French President Emmanuel Macron talking about this needs to be a situation discussed at the G7 summit, calling it an international emergency.
It is an international emergency, but unfortunately, we don't live in a world where these resources are considered part of our international legacy. They're considered national property, and Brazil, under the current government especially, is focused not on the environment and ecosystem protection, but on short-term private economic gain. And so we're basically trading in a precious global resource for a short-term economic benefit. I have to point out there's even a discussion that Trump's tariffs on soybeans, which has forced China not to buy U.S. soybeans, but to buy Brazilian soybeans, is contributing to the pressure on Brazil to cut down more of its rainforest to grow more soybeans. We live in a world economy, but we don't act as though these are global resources.
As you just mentioned, this rainforest is producing 20% of our planet's oxygen, and it's on fire. It doesn't appear that there are any efforts to even put this fire out, according to what I'm hearing from Brazil's leader. He says he doesn't have the resources. So if this really is a matter of causing irreversible planetary damage at a time when the planet is already in peril, should the world step in and try to put out this fire? And if 70-some thousand fires are burning, what's to stop it at this point if somebody doesn't?
There's nothing really to stop it. I mean, forest fires are difficult enough when they're caused naturally, but when they're intentionally set, the first thing that has to be done is to stop the intentional destruction of the forest.
If the Amazon rainforest is what we call the lungs of the planet, producing 20% of our planet's oxygen, what impacts on the environment does that have?
The risk is that the broad ecosystem services that the Amazon provides, the production of our oxygen and the removal of carbon dioxide, the incredibly rich, irreplaceable biodiversity, the native communities that have lived in the Amazon forever. And I think it's just another slash and cut to the health of the planet's ecosystem. That's what's facing us.
That was Peter Glick, one of the scientists who worked on the original U.S. climate assessment, speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Among other top stories in the world, U.S. officials say Israel bombed an Iranian weapons depot in Iraq last month. The July attack, one of three explosions at Iraqi militia bases, killed two Iranian military commanders. North Korea warned on Friday that the U.S. should either get ready for a nuclear dialogue or get ready for a standoff. And more sanctions would be a miscalculation. Plus, a Chinese general warned his country would not sit by idly if the U.S. sells $8 billion worth of F-16 jets to Taiwan. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA News.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Dan Friedel. As Sudan takes more steps in its transition to civilian rule, with the swearing-in of a sovereign council and a prime minister, it introduces both jubilation and uncertainty about pitfalls ahead. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
A new technocrat prime minister and a sovereign council of 6 civilians and 5 military officers are ushering a new chapter in Sudan. The changes have been met with street celebrations, music, poetry, and fireworks. But for a region where revolutions have failed in Egypt, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, some experts are torn between hope and doubt regarding a successful transition. For Noha Zain, a Sudanese who is a visiting professor at Rice University in Texas, the euphoria is based on hope and trust.
People insisted and they encouraged each other to continue, led by the Sudanese Professional Association under the umbrella of the Freedom and Change Forces. The will of the Sudanese people themselves. They really now very aware about their rights, about their strength to change their destiny in Sudan.
Some analysts say the pro-democracy leaders studied the uprising in Egypt several years ago and concluded that they would need to keep popular pressure on the government to force a democratic transition. At the same time, some analysts say the movement's leaders were mature enough to agree with the military on the appointment of General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan as a chairman of the new sovereign council. Burhan will head the council for 21 months, then a civilian takes over for 18 months until there is an election. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortegas says the United States welcomes the formation of the sovereign council.
The United States remains a steadfast partner of the Sudanese people in their pursuit of a civilian-led government that will advance peace, security, and prosperity and respect for human rights.
Abdullah Hamdok, an economist with international expertise in good governance, has become Sudan's new prime minister. But some analysts, such as Professor Zain, are concerned that elements of former President Omar al-Bashir's government are deeply entrenched and that political network could undermine Hamdok's efforts to revive the economy. A particularly difficult challenge in the transition is the politicized security sector. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, says military leaders still think they should have the upper hand in Sudan. One sign of that is the control the military had in naming the defense and interior ministers.
It remains unclear how these actions are going to translate into further democratic change. Democratic rights that were spelled out in the agreement are being upheld on the ground. You know, rights of assembly, rights of expression, freedom of press, those types of things I think will be some signals to whether there is some continuing commitment to the transition.
Siegel said despite the promising welcome for civilian rule, fears remain of that a counter-revolution is possible and powerful security leaders may be unwilling to let the transition move forward. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
The controversial Boeing 737 MAX jet, grounded since March after a pair of crashes, may be on the verge of getting back in the air. Pilots from around the world are being invited for simulator tests of its new software, the Associated Press reports.
The Federal Aviation Administration wants airline pilots from around the world to test the changes Boeing is making to flight control software on the grounded 737 MAX jet. That's according to two people briefed on the situation who spoke on condition of anonymity. The testing will be in flight simulators, not actual MAX jets. The FAA wants some of the pilots to have little experience on the Boeing 737. The MAX jets have been grounded since March after the second of two crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia that killed 346 people. Faulty sensor readings in the MAX's flight control software caused automated systems to push down the noses of the aircraft. I'm Mike Rossia.
Human rights advocates are urging lawmakers in New Zealand to drop restrictions on the intake of African and Middle Eastern refugees. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
New Zealand's immigration regulations prevent the resettlement of refugees from Africa and the Middle East, unless they already have family members living in the country. The measures were introduced by the previous centre-right government in 2010, due in part to security concerns, as New Zealand focused on facilitating immigration from Asia. Campaigners say the policy is discriminatory and undermines the integrity of a nation that's been praised for its response to deadly mosque attacks in March, when a lone gunman murdered 51 people and wounded dozens more in an attack in the city of Christchurch. Refugees from Syria and Somalia were among the victims. Rights groups have filed a petition on the so-called family link immigration rules for Middle Eastern and African refugees to a parliamentary committee, which is reviewing the measures. Some lawmakers agree the regulations are racist, but New Zealand's Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters told TVNZ the policy is fair.
Well, it can't be racist. Well, how could it be possibly racist when all the ones coming in are brown or black? Because how could that possibly be racist? None of these refugee countries have said that New Zealand is racist. That's why they're queuing up to come here, because we're not.
The current immigration policy doesn't apply to people who apply for asylum in New Zealand, although the isolated South Pacific island nation has few migrants seeking asylum compared to other developed countries. The government in Wellington has announced plans to increase the number of refugees it takes in each year by 500 to 1,500, beginning in the year 2020. New Zealand has a population of about 4.7 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This week marks the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first African slaves to what is now the United States. The legacy of that fateful voyage lingers in modern America, where African Americans continue to face racism. VOA's Africa to America Town Hall examines some of that legacy. We bring you excerpts of that conversation. Panelist Robert Trent Vinson, an associate professor of history and Africana studies at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, addressed the issue of reparations, a way to compensate the descendants of nearly 4 million African slaves for the theft of their ancestors' labor.
When we look at the racial gap in terms of wealth, On average, the black family has 4% of the wealth of an average white family. When we look at health disparities, educational disparities that cut across racial lines, that is the result of intergenerational wealth gap and accumulation. And when we talk about slavery, we can't talk about it just as an evil. That's one thing. But we also have to talk about it as theft, the theft of people's labor. And the largest slave society in world history, 4 million people by 1860.
Many leaders of U.S. civil rights and black empowerment movements had ties to the cultures and liberation movements in Africa. However, the panelists said those ties have eroded. Cassandra Newby Alexander, the dean of the Liberal Arts College at Norfolk State University, shared her thoughts on why that was.
I think the reason is more complicated is because after segregation in this country officially ended, and as we went through the 1970s and we started to see the removal of at least the visual signs of this inequality and separation, there was a sense among many African Americans that we had arrived. Mm-hmm. We didn't need to keep pushing black history. We didn't need to keep seeing ourselves as part of a diaspora, as part of a global community.
The civil rights movement began to end discrimination against black Americans, but it has spread beyond that. The panel moderator, Peniel E. Joseph, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, said black women had much to do with the expansion.
I think what Black Lives Matter has done, like Professor Vincent has said, is really placed black women and queer folks, LGBTQ, at the center of these conversations, and making a very similar parallel argument to what black people did in the 19th and early 20th century, saying that if black people got and achieved citizenship, it would reverberate to everyone. I'm talking about Native Americans, people who are physically and mentally challenged, people who are on the margins of society. But what we did is that we marginalized people within our own community, especially black women. So what black feminism teaches us, and we've got these great teachers like Sonia Sanchez, we've got Angela Davis, we've got all these brilliant black women here. What it teaches us is how black people's particular story can be universal.
You can watch the entire town hall at voanews.com or youtube.com/VOA video. VOA will have more on this crucial aspect of U.S. history and society in the coming months.
This is Science in a Minute.
Sleep deprivation has long been linked with having a higher risk for cardiovascular disease and even death from coronary heart disease. A study published in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine suggests one possible reason is that having a bad night of sleep can cause blood pressure to spike. The researchers studied 300 men and women between the ages of 21 and 70 with no history of heart problems. The participants wore portable blood pressure cuffs and had their blood pressure randomly measured over a two-day, two-night period. To gauge their sleep efficiency, they also wore devices that measured movement as they slept. The researchers found that the participants with lower sleep efficiency readings also showed an increase in blood pressure during the night and a higher systolic or upper number blood pressure the following day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
What's up? I'm Jackson Fungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
You know, it's Upfront News Show, blazing up the place.
Upfront looks at issues that affect you, interesting news, and of course music, entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it. So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.
You've been listening to the August 23rd edition of International Edition. You can find more at voanews.com. Also, like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our executive producer, Kate Pound Dawson, director Daniel Brown, engineer Thomas Blondet. I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Enjoy your weekend.